The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And if you are looking at the YouTube stream or the video on our own website, I should say, you might be wondering, where are we? This looks very similar to the studio in Edmund. This is our new Edstone studio, the first time that it's being used. It's a beautiful studio to sit in. I've got to get used to two different camera angles. We've not had that before, so if I don't know where to look, this is my first time. I barely feel like I'm used to speaking on video, let alone having two video cameras. You'll notice we're pretty similar as well to the studio setup that we have over there. I guess we don't have any Trumpet Daily lettering behind me in any form. Maybe we will change that at some point. I don't know, but it is a beautiful studio. Sam Livingston has been working very hard getting it set up, and it's very nice. The board, we've got a very nice control booth there as well. Lots of gadgets and gizmos. There's a long table, and you can barely see any table. It's covered with so much stuff, but should allow for hopefully a nice professional setup. Well, we've got a lot to get through on today's show. Lots of news coming up later. We've got a big segment looking at the connection between wealth and woke. Why are the super rich pushing society to the super left? We'll look at the Great Reset. We're going to look at fire-resistant furniture as well. Tie that in there. There's a very important story that there's a lot about it that's really aggravating and frustrating, but there's a lot about it that's just right from your Bible as well. So I'm really excited to get into that. But first, I just wanted to cover a few other bits of news. We've had a very simple and obvious international relations lecture or lesson from Iraq over the last couple of days. About this time last year, or I guess a little bit before, we saw Iran strike at a U.S. airbase in Iraq while Mr. Trump was president, and he responded strongly. He killed Qassem Soleimani. There were all the pundits exploded. This is going to be the end of the world, etc. It wasn't. Iran stopped. You know, Mr. Trump stood up to Iran, and it worked. Iran backed down, and they were a bit quieter for a bit. Now, Iran struck again at America just a few weeks ago with Mr. Biden as president. He didn't really do much. So yesterday they struck again. They hit the An al-Assad airbase. That's in the Anbar province of Iraq yesterday morning. They used Iranian-made Arash artillery rockets. I think Iraq also has those same rockets, but these were an Iranian variant. This was the same base that Iran attacked last year that triggered the killing of Soleimani. And this was President Joe Biden's response. This is clip 3.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
US troops
thank
were
you.
With rocket
thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
We are following that through right now. Thank God no one was killed by the rocket. One individual, a contractor, died of a heart attack. But we're identifying who's responsible, and we'll make judgments from that point. Okay. Thank you.
Such a weak response, right? Look at the hypocrisy there. You know, you had a police officer killed, who was present at the Capitol Hill riots, and he died, and it looks like he didn't even die on the same day as the riots, and you know they're making all of the details as murky as possible. And did that death even have any connection to those riots? Well, that doesn't matter. Those riots, they're domestic terrorists. We need to upend society to track these people down. We need to stop anybody saying anything vaguely right-wing because of what happened in these riots and the need to confront them. Now, though, in Iraq, you have Iranian-backed attack on an Iraqi base. a guy has a heart attack. It looks like because of that attack. And then the response from the White House is, well, nobody was killed. Maybe we'll do something. Maybe not. This guy dying there, well, that doesn't necessitate any big response. That's the message we're getting from the White House. And in some ways, this weakness that we're seeing is even worse because just last year, President Trump proved that strength works, that confronting Iran works. But really, you know, so much of the Obama administration, and that's what this is really, an Obama administration, agree with Iran, that the US is fundamentally a force for evil in the world. And so they don't have the strength of will to stand up for Iran. They don't even believe standing up for America is the right thing to do. Well, there's another very important news story coming out of Iraq. This could potentially be pretty big. I think the Pope is arriving tomorrow for a historic 4-day visit to Iraq. This is, I think, the first time a Pope has ever visited Iraq. Others have intended to make the trip. They've never actually made it. So this could be very interesting to see what happens here. He's going to meet the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. They're scheduled to have a 40-minute meeting alone. I think that's on Saturday. It looks like I didn't quite write that down, but that's during the trip he's going to meet there. So al-Sistani, he's the leading Shiite cleric in Iraq, one of the top religious officials there. And it looks like part of this, you know, he's going there as a peacemaker. That's what he says, and then the intent of this visit is. And it looks like this meeting might be an attempt to kind of put a wedge between Iraqi Shiites and then the Iranian Shia regime, the Catholic Crux publication. They wrote, with this meeting, Francis is implicitly recognizing al-Sistani as the chief interlocutor of Shiite Islam over his rival Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. News of the meeting heightened long-standing rivalries between the Shiite seminaries of Najaf and the Iran city of Qom over which stands at the center of the Shiite world. And I think they're exaggerating the differences between Iraqi and Iranian Shiites, but I think it does make sense that the Pope would want to try and open a wedge there. You know, there's a lot about the Pope traveling to the Middle East that is really prophetic. You know, Daniel chapter 11 has a lot to say about the role of Europe in the Middle East and the role of Pope Francis in the Middle East. Oh, not Pope Francis, but the role of the Catholic Church in the Middle East. You know, Daniel, the latter parts of Daniel chapter 11 talks about this clash that's coming between the King of the North, and that's referring to a European power, and the King of the South, this radical Islamic power led by Iran. And this chapter talks about the Catholic Church eventually moving its headquarters to Jerusalem. So they're involved in this clash as well. And now we see the Pope going over there, playing a bigger role in dealing with Iran, in talking with Iran. I mean, from prophecy, we know that Iraq is going to be tied with Iran. This was one of the very early predictions from the Trumpet magazine all the way back in the early 90s, before anyone was really, you know, the big bad guy for everybody at that time was Iraq and Saddam Hussein. But the Trumpet was saying, well, Iraq is going to fall to Iran. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had that article, is Iraq going to fall to Iran? And so, you know, the Pope's not going to pry Iraq away from Iran. But knowing about this confrontation, it makes sense that he would try, that he would go over there and try to bring about this, or to make Iraq a European ally instead of an Iranian ally. So he's going over there. He's getting involved as a peacemaker. And the Bible has a lot to say about the Catholic Church playing a role as a peacemaker, playing a role in Middle East peace. That's absolutely critical to Bible prophecy. And you see, you see that just really accelerating with the Catholic Church going over here. And at the same time, you know, Joe Biden would love to pull out of the Middle East. So is this going to be part of this shift where we see Europe being the one that deals much more with Iran and what's going on in the Middle East as America pulls back? And another angle to this is it is a pretty dangerous move for the Pope to be going over there. There was a historian/war blogger, Omar Mohammed, and he would write dispatches during the kind of the period with ISIS and the fighting going on there from Mosul, where the Pope's visiting. He wrote, I don't hide from you the fact that I have concerns for the Pope's visit. I am worried that the pro-Iranian militias will use this visit, as well as the Pope's meeting with Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani,
as an excuse to justify their crimes in Iraq. And then this Crux, this Catholic magazine, talked to a few other journalists and things who talked about, or said there are many risks ahead for this visit. Pope the Zero Hedge wrote, Pope Francis's upcoming trip to Iraq is widely being considered as a security nightmare, as both his own Vatican Protection Service and local police and military officials scramble to ensure nothing goes wrong. It wrote, adding to security fears is this that cities across the country have witnessed continued major bomb attacks, including a January twin suicide attack on a busy marketplace in Baghdad this past January, which killed over 30 people. So there's a risk that something could happen to the Pope as well. Some kind of attack or an attempted attack on the Pope you could really see how that would fuel this Daniel 11 clash that's talked about in the Bible. But so much of this idea of a Pope now going over to Iraq, taking the lead in negotiations with to try and bring peace to the Middle East, Europe getting more involved, that is so prophetic. That is right in line with what we've been writing about for years. And we have our free book, The King of the South. I'd really encourage you to read that if you haven't. It just explains so much of what's going on in the Middle East. And there's so much of that book that has been proven true already. It's your guide to understanding what's happening here. And that'll put this Pope's visit in just remarkable context. There's a chapter even just on the Catholic Church and its involvement in the Middle East. And with all of our literature, you can get that for free on our website, thetrumpet.com. Just click on the literature chat tab. That is a bit of a mouthful. Literature tab at the top right-hand corner of the page. Well, just one more piece of news I think I'll bring, so I have plenty of time to get to my main story. A bit closer to home, Britain had a new budget yesterday, and we're starting to see some of the long-term economic effects of the coronavirus, or more accurately, the coronavirus restrictions, what we've been doing to ourselves because of coronavirus. One of the big pieces of news is furlough is extended until October. So if you can't work during COVID due to the restrictions, well, the government will pay a good chunk of your salary to you while you stay at home. And with the furlough being extended to October, there have been now people basically being paid by the government to sit at home and do nothing for 18 months. That's a huge amount of time and a huge amount of money. How many of those jobs are still going to even be there when they come back? And we're also starting to see tax rises. Just about all of taxes going up across the board, I guess apart from a few sales taxes that affect restaurants and the hospitality industry. A lot of it's done in a fairly stealthy way, but it's the biggest rise in taxation since 1993. And the tax burden now is at its highest level for the UK since the 1960s. But here's the really surprising part of that. These tax rises, they're estimated to bring in an extra £21 billion over the next 5 years. I think that was one estimate I saw. Total COVID spending is more like £400 billion. So we've got the highest tax burden in well over 50 years, but it barely puts a dent in all of the COVID spending. This is just the very start of the economic repercussions, the economic carnage that's been wrought by the government's response to coronavirus. Biggest tax rises in 50 years or the biggest tax burden in 50 years, and we're not really even starting to pay off some of what we've... In fact, I'm pretty sure we'll still be borrowing more money even with this, not even beginning to pay off that debt. And this is the kind of thing that's coming to America too. You know, every country or every developed country, they've spent massive amount on this, and it's going to have a huge, huge impact. And again, that's something that plays a big role in Bible prophecy. We've been saying for years to watch for an economic crisis and the role that could play in the rise of Europe. Well, we'll take a quick break, and when I get back, we'll get into that main story. We'll look at why the radically rich are so often radically left and radically trying to change society.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion.
The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Oh, and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. It is the Robbers Cave Campout. I think in headquarters they were planning on going for a hike today. I'm not sure Mr. Flurry is planning on going along. They've got trampolining tomorrow. But I think he's planning on taking the show tomorrow, so I guess he didn't fancy going trampolining. We've started a bit of our Robbers Cave camp out here as well. We're still on campus. We're not able to travel this year the way that we often have in the past, but they've got the lounge set up really nicely with a lot of couches, and it still feels just like Robbers Cave. We had a really fun evening last night, just playing some games, relaxing, talking, reading, just like tend to do on the Robbers Cave campout. So it's been a great start to the campout so far over here. I'm sure it has in America as well. But the main thing I want to talk about today is just the role that the wealthy, that big business are playing in this kind of radical transformation in the United States, this kind of radical shift that we're seeing within families, within society. You know, we've had a lot to say, and the Bible has a lot to say about the role politicians are playing in this, the role the media are playing in this, the role even religion and churches are playing in this radical shift, really towards sin and law breaking in our society. But it has a lot to say as well about what the wealthy and what the rich have, the role that they play as well. And we're bombarded by stories about this. Some of them can seem pretty, well, some of them are pretty silly. I mean, what was the big one this week was about some publisher canceling Dr. Seuss, getting rid of a bunch of Dr. Seuss books. Last week, Hasbro kind of became one of the biggest companies to go woke, where they announced that Mr. Potato Head would be losing the Mr. And they said they were going to be doing this to promote gender equality and inclusion. And they had some new product that would enable kids to create their own potato families however they liked. If they wanted to have a family that had two dads and a kid, or two mums and a kid, well, that's they could go ahead and make that with this family kit that they were making. And then the backlash led them to kind of change course pretty quickly and kind of emphasize that the Mr. would only be disappearing from the brand name. I think it was also last week we saw about Coca-Cola and their training their employees, that there were all this training they were making available to all of their employees to be less white. I think it was Deloitte that's had been in the headlines a fair bit for their unconscious bias training, something that's been adopted by a host of big banks and big businesses. This radical left idea that, you know, depending on your skin color, you may have been born racist, basically. And you need to have this training to get that racism beaten out of you. And so many big businesses, they've been signing on with this. I think it's the same in America. Definitely in the UK, though, you just have certain times of year where just about every single business will be flying the rainbow flag. You know, if you want to avoid a business that has not backed the LGBT movement, you might have to start growing your own food. Storing your money under a mattress. It's just everywhere. You know, a friend showed me how his banking app, I think it was back when more people had smartphones and things, but a friend showed me on his banking app where the bank had just changed their logo to a rainbow in support of this movement.
It's so hard to avoid. But why is this? Why do you have so many businesses going woke? Why do you have so many big, influential business people pushing for changing a society and an end to capitalism as we know it? We'll play some clips from that pretty soon. What is going on here? Well, I think there's a number of different reasons. Part of it is just self-interest. You know, in general, businesses try to appeal to the relatively young. Because if they have a job and they're working as compared to somebody who's retired, they probably have more disposable income. And if you win them as a customer, you've got many more years of them purchasing things. And it's amazing the lengths that customers will, or the businesses will go to try and win over some the people in this age category. Young people are also, they're more likely to have kids. And then there's a whole load of spending that comes with that. I was reading an article years ago about the lengths Target would go to try and work out if somebody was pregnant so they could start advertising all these different products to them. The scary thing is, they were better at knowing if somebody was... There was one incident where they basically detected that some teenage girl was pregnant before their parents knew. They were able to, with kind of data mining and big data, figure that out. So there's a lot of money on the line for trying to appeal to this younger demographic. And that demographic is much more left-wing. The latest Pew Party Identity Survey found that only 38% of millennials were Republican or lean Republican, whereas 54% were Democrat or lean Democrat. And so companies that market especially to the young tend especially to adopt these kind of woke marketing strategies. Nike, for example, or Nike, I think, as they say in America, which is probably the more accurate pronunciation anyway, I think that those under 34 make up 43% of their business. So they're very much skewed to the young. Starbucks, 89% of their customers are under 40. And so you see them really supporting the radical left. And then with a lot of these businesses, it's not just young, it's urban, the urban young, people living in cities that they really try to appeal to. And this is an even more left-wing cohort. 31% of urban registered voters lean Republican compared to 62% Democrat. That's a 2-to-1 advantage there. You're twice as likely to find Democrats. The New Republic, they're a left-wing publication, but they were looking into why all these businesses were going left, and they said they've just opened their eyes to how important political involvement is to their profits. You know, the left has become pretty quick to target businesses that transgress their standards. I didn't write the scripture down, but in Isaiah, it talks about, those that depart from evil make themselves a prey. And you really see that when it comes to some of these businesses and some of these left-wing mobs. They'll go after businesses that just don't support a cause, that don't support Black Lives Matter. It's not that they have done something to offend the radical left. They have just refused. They just haven't done anything. And that's not good enough. And that leads to these businesses to be being attacked. So even just for the sake of making money for trying to appeal to these young voters or young consumers, they'll tend to go this way. Just for self-preservation or just for an easy life, they'll tend to go this way. And this is why you'll have some of these companies go to the left, even if it doesn't make them money. The Chartered Institute of Marketing noted that businesses that have dabbled with this strategy, this kind of woke strategy, have seen their share prices fall as a result. You know, Gillette, for example, the value of that brand plunged by about $8 billion after their kind of infamous anti-men advertisement. So it works for some companies. It's pretty disastrous for others. But it's self-defense. They want to defend themselves against being attacked. They also want to defend themselves against government. You know, there's a strong self-interest for trying to do this. For the left, for businesses to campaign for these kind of high visibility causes, but ones that don't hit their bottom line so much. You know, a tax rise, that's something the left likes, but that's not something that you see these big businesses getting on board. You don't see Amazon or Walmart Walmart's not the worst when it comes to some of these far left initiatives, but you don't see them getting behind calls for tax rises. Instead, they call for these society changes that don't affect their bottom line so directly. Being left-wing on social issues doesn't stop them supporting the free market. And you see this very self-interested support of some of these causes and just the causes that they support. And I think we've talked about this before. Mr. Hilliko, I think, had an article on it recently. You know, the way these kind of the most woke of woke firms will use slave labor in China to make their profit, to make their products, to make money, all the while complaining for Black Lives Matter and boycotting people that had a slave owner in their family 200 years ago. Complete hypocrisy. Nothing really to do with a moral stand. It's all about political posturing and appealing to consumers. But when those same moral values would say, well, we're not going to use slave labor in China to make our footwear, well, they don't listen to that. And they're perfectly happy to cozy up to the Chinese regime. So there's a lot of self-interest motivating a lot of these companies to go left. And you see big business moving that way. But it's not just big business. It's the super rich as well. You see the super rich spending a lot on politics, often in ways that are hard to see. And this is something that happens on both sides of the political aisle. You do have rich donors to the Republican Party, for example. But especially the way that some of these people that want to radically change society do it is not very transparent. Spiked had a really good article last month called "The Billionaire Takeover of Civil Society." And you know, the way that a lot of these radical left individuals will get involved here is not in the kind of the straightforward way of donating to super PACs and to just donating straight to candidates and things like that. No, they're after a much wider transformation of society. And so to do that, they're trying to kind of change people's minds on a grassroots level. And this article zoomed in on one individual, an eBay billionaire, Pierre Omidyar. And I'd never really heard of him before, just one billionaire. And he funds a huge range of enterprises. I think we've got the article that we can put up, and it's got a whole bunch of graphics in there, if our guys could get that on the screen if you're watching the video, where you can see that this one individual funds all of these different groups, and there's no real indication that they're a group being funded by a billionaire. There's nothing to tell you that they're related. They've got names like the Democracy Fund, the Healthy Democracy, the MacArthur Foundation. They sound like they're completely independent. They also sound like they've got nothing to do with each other. And then there's this whole spider's web that spreads on out from this. These groups will fund other groups that will fund other groups. Maybe we could put that up on the main screen rather than just the secondary monitor if we can to get a bit of a look at that. So you have groups like the Sunrise Movement, and they're an organization that works with AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, and they push the Green New Deal. And so they get their funding from this billionaire, but on all these roundabout routes, and then it gets funneled into these politicians. And so the Spiked article states, if one accepts what givers like Omidyar et al. Say, it becomes apparent that rather than participating in traditional acts of charity like founding a hospital for the needy, they are attempting to engage in social engineering. That is, using their resources to artificially change the structure of society to what they think it should be. If successful, this would amount to an extreme circumvention of democracy, utilizing money not just to win elections, but to substitute paid or subsidized content for actual support and thereby flip an entire political culture onto a different track by amplifying some voices and drowning out others. Moreover, just to keep things interesting, this is viewed in quite explicit investment terms, and investors tend to expect a return in their investment. And once again, you do get right-wing donors, but they don't tend to want to fundamentally change society. They're not working like this, but you have a whole load of left-wing donors that are. And one of these billionaire-funded climate change movements, they posted an hour-long video talking about how to bring about these changes. I think this was the Sunrise Society, and they talked about how they had to become kind of this dominant political alignment that defines the common sense of society. And they said that they need to take over the entire United States and all the institutions in it. And to do that, they need to begin finding and developing our first leaders. And so they've been setting up these dormitories where they can bring young people in for 3 to 6 months to create leaders that they can then send out to educate more people. And the spiked article states, on one level, it's great that young people are taking part in politics, but on another level, it is incredibly fake. The youthful participants aren't so much being empowered as being instrumentalized. After all, they're part of a portfolio of an investment fund that is using them to shift power, with part of the strategy being to shame politicians for not being nice enough to hysterical children. And it talks about how even these big business-backed charities, quote-unquote, and NGOs, they're basically just going out and grooming and finding young people and training them to be the faces of the movement, because it's a lot harder for a politician to argue with a room full of young people and gain media sympathy than it is for them to argue with a rich billionaire and gain media sympathy. They don't want to make it look like there are rich billionaires behind this. And then they funnel all these money into research organizations. And these research organizations, they describe themselves as independent or non-profit. And you look, if you go to their websites and you look at the material they put out, it sounds like it's a bunch of scientists doing experiments, doing research to help produce good policies. And that sounds good, doesn't it? We would want people to study the effects and what's the effect of this policy or that policy. And that's what they sound like. It's not at all what they are. You look at what the actual jobs are, and most of the people working there are working in PR, public relations, or they're strategy managers. And there aren't really any actual scientists or experts doing research. And then these research organizations, they'll then work to really influence the media. They'll put out sample op-eds that you can use to kind of, for journalists, to go easily write their own op-ed that says the same thing. And it will be complete with facts and statistics backing up the point that they want them to make. And people have made this point. You look at, say, like local media channels across the United States. I should have found some of the videos where they're all saying the same thing. This is part of the way that it happens. Billionaire funds money to a research organization which puts out sample op-eds, which it then sends to all of these different media groups that already push a bias that these media groups agree with. And then they all produce these very similar worded pieces or radio segments or video segments. The article states, its goal is to propagate a kind of intellectual dishonesty aimed to make it appear that one centralized opinion is coming from many different sources, who are, in this scenario, little more than sock puppets these very organizations complain about so much. Be like if, we have thetrumpet.com, be like if we went and founded 50 other websites that all said similar things in different words to make it sound like there's a lot of people that agree with us. And then these different groups all work together. So you'll have a quote-unquote independent research institute, and they'll publish a study on fake news. And this study will encourage people to use a independent, quote-unquote, fact-checking body that also receives money from exactly the same billionaire. And they don't tell you about these links. So again, it just sounds like a bunch of journalists or experts talking about the need for freedom in the media. And it's really a billionaire saying, this is what I think you should think. And it's interesting to see how many people on the left do get money and from these big businesses. You look up who funds someone like AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, and her top donors, among them, you've got Google, Amazon, Apple. You've got the University of California, I think, University of New York. And a lot of these billionaires have some very kind of utopianist ideas. And you can't blame them for wanting to fix society. There is a lot wrong with society. We talk about that all the time on this show. But some of the worst ideas in history, worst disasters, have come from people trying to bring about utopia. And you see this on display, especially when you have some of these big groups of billionaires getting together. The World Economic Forum is a classic example of this. It brings together billionaires and politicians from around the world. And to show the kind of radical dreams that many of these in the super rich have, here's a couple of clips from the promotional video for the World Economic Forum that was meeting, I think, virtually in Davos in January. This is clip one.
Recovery from the pandemic is an opportunity. We can see rays of hope in the form of a vaccine, but there is no vaccine for the planet. Nature needs a bailout.
You don't want to go back to the status quo that you had before, simply because it was the status quo that got us here.
With everything falling apart, we can reshape the world in ways we couldn't before. Ways that better address so many of the challenges we face. And that's why so many are calling for a Great Reset. A Great Reset? That sounds more like buzzword bingo masking some nefarious plan for world domination. Hands up, this kind of slogan hasn't gone down well. But all we really want to say is that we all have an opportunity to build a better world.
So we want to build a better world. We want to build things, build back better. That's another similar catchphrase that you're seeing. And the World Economic Forum, it brings together, like I said, billionaires and politicians. You heard on there, if you didn't see the video from the UN Secretary General, I think the head of the OECD as well. This next clip, this is from the CEO of Salesforce. So we're looking at a major businessman. Here's what he says about the radical changes society needs.
And with climate change set to dwarf the damage caused by the pandemic, the message from 2020 should be abundantly clear.
Capitalism, as we know it, is dead. This obsession that we have had with maximizing profits for shareholders alone has led to incredible inequality and a planetary emergency.
Capitalism, as we know it, is dead. This economic system that is not perfect, but has done more to lift more people around the world out of poverty than any other, that has done more to stop tyrannical governments, you know, starving their own people into submission, like you saw with the Soviet Union. It's dead. We need something different. Klaus Schwab, he's heavily involved with the World Economic Forum. He's one of the most kind of big business leaders really trying to push this. He wrote a book called COVID-19, The Great Reset. And he wrote, at the time of writing, June 2020, the pandemic continues to worsen globally. Many of us are pondering when things will return to normal. The short response is never. Nothing will ever return to the broken sense of normalcy that prevailed prior to the crisis, because the coronavirus pandemic marks a fundamental inflection point in our global trajectory. I mean, Mr. Flurry on yesterday's show talked about the two Americas, the way that you do have Florida and Texas and some of these other states going back to normal. Meanwhile, you have President Biden saying, well, I'm not sure if we'll be able to get back to normal by this time next year. I'm not meant to talk about that. Why are people sounding like that? Well, you've got Klaus Schwab here saying, well, we're never going back to normal. Never. I saw a headline, I think it was just this morning or yesterday, saying, well, we need a lockdown every 2 or 3 years to save the environment. We need to keep up with these policies. So why would big business be pushing for these kind of radical changes? Well, like I said, I think in part it's to appeal to younger consumers. In part, it's to try and stop the radical left from punishing them with things like high taxes or rules that get them out of business entirely. I think it's part because some of these people, they genuinely believe this. You know, they see problems in society. They genuinely believe that this is the solution. They've been convinced by the climate change propaganda that we see everywhere. But there's another important reason why a lot of big businesses love this kind of thing. You know, big business tends to do very well with big government. They love big government. They have some massive incentives to get in bed with big government. It's something we see on display in the European Union all the time. Your left-wing politicians continually push this fiction that businesses hate regulation coming from government. And it's not true. Big business loves regulation, most regulation. I mean, there are bits of regulation that I think they don't like that could harm them. But in general, they love it. You know, big businesses can afford to hire lobbyists that will shape what this regulation is going to look like. They can hire experts to ensure that they do comply with this law. You know, for the amount of money that they make, hiring a few experts to do that doesn't make much difference to their bottom line. If a government regulator wants to come after them, they can hire lawyers to fight back and to push back. All of that is far out of reach of small businesses. You know, if you're a small business a mom-and-pop store or, you know, a sole trader, something like that. You can't afford to hire a lawyer to make sure you understand these latest regulations coming out. If a government department decides to investigate you, that could finish you. You know, again, you can't eat those legal costs. And so regulation has the potential to stop competitors to big business before they even get started. You know, this small, nimble startup that has a better way, a cheaper way of doing things, well, that's going to struggle to get off the ground. Small businesses are hurt. Consumers are hurt. The poor are hurt. But big business tends to love it. And so you've got a massive business that's grown up around big business drawing close to government. The total spending just by registered lobbyists in 1998, it was $2.4 billion. It hit a peak in 2009, Mr. Obama's first year, of $3.9 billion US dollars, nearly doubling. And these figures are adjusted for inflation. And that's just the very official kind of like people that are registered as lobbyists, this money that they spend. That's $3.7 million on average spent lobbying each member of Congress from this industry. But when it works, the results from working with big government for big business can be spectacular. Absolutely massive. And this is where I want to get into fire-resistant furniture. You know, just about every chair you own probably has a label or a tag on it somewhere saying it's been treated with fire-resistant chemicals. I'm sure the one I'm sitting on right now does. I know our sound panels, or the to try and cut down on the echo in this room, they have a thing on there saying they've been treated with them. Why? Why do we have fire-resistant furniture everywhere? Well, maybe you'd assume that some scientist came up with this bright idea. Hey, I've discovered this chemical. It can help stop fires by spraying our furniture with it. And they brought this to the attention of government, and they put it in place. No, that's not what happened. Or maybe an enterprising member of the fire brigade thought it up. You know, we're getting all these fires. What if we make our furniture fire resistant? Could that help? Or maybe there are consumers that really want, you know, we're fed up of fires. What can we do to stop it? None of that is true. In fact, it's the opposite. Fire brigades around the world are trying to get these fire retardant chemicals banned. They're trying to get rid of these laws on fire resistant furniture, to get it out of there. Because these chemicals that we put in everything that we sit on and sleep on, basically, don't really do much to stop fires. There is no really good evidence at all that they do anything much to stop fires. And instead, all they mean that when a house does burn down, there are all kinds of extra toxic chemicals in the air. And there are lots of studies showing that members of the fire brigades have been really negatively impacted by this, that there are cancers and all kinds of diseases that they're getting because of the extra chemicals put into burning buildings by these toxic chemicals we're putting in all our seats. In the UK, I'm assuming it's the same within the US, since the 1990s, most fire deaths in injuries haven't actually been from burning. They've come from toxic smoke. It's toxic chemicals being burnt that are by far the bigger issue. And it's not just the fire brigades and firemen that get hurt. These kind of regulations mean that probably every night your child sleeps on a mattress that is full of chemicals that have been banned in pesticides and sheep dips and things like that. You know, they won't give it to sheep, but they'll pass a law saying that it has to be in your child's mattress. The Guardian had an article recently. They wrote, mothers in the UK and US have the world's highest recorded concentrations of a toxic class of flame retardants in their breast milk. Banned fire retardants have been recently discovered in umbilical cord blood. We have no clear idea of how they might affect the development and future health of fetuses, but we know that they are persistent, accumulative, and associated with cancer and disruption of the hormonal and reproductive systems. And these kind of chemicals tend to be much more commonly found in babies and young children. I guess because they're just spending time sleeping and crawling around and climbing over things and on the ground in the dust. There's a Arlene Blum, a Californian chemist who's fighting against these chemicals. She wrote, when we're eating organic, we're avoiding very small amounts of pesticides. Then we sit on our couch that can contain a pound of chemicals that's from the same family as banned pesticides like DDT. So why are they here? Why are we surrounded by these chemicals? They don't benefit us. They don't benefit firemen. They don't want them. Who do they benefit? Well, they benefit chemical companies. Making fire retardant chemicals is big business. You know, look around your room. Every chair, every sofa, every mattress. I think carpets in a lot of circumstances. Electronic equipment. They're all treated with this chemical. You know, that's thousands of pounds of or kilograms of this being, or probably billions of kilograms, manufactured each year. And by getting these laws in place, and I think for the US it's largely in California, by getting these laws in place, they can these chemical companies can make a killing. They've created this market that wouldn't obviously otherwise be there. And they can make tons of money. And in some ways, one of the most surprising things about this is none of this is new. This is not a recent discovery. 2012, I think the Chicago Tribune, for example, they had a series of investigative articles in this. They described a decades-long campaign of deception that has loaded the furniture and electronics in American homes with pounds of toxic chemicals linked to cancer, neurological defects, developmental problems, and impaired fertility. These powerful industries distort science in ways that overstate the benefits of chemicals, create a phony consumer watchdog group that stoked public fears of fire and helped organize and steer an association of top fire officials that spent more than a decade campaigning for their cause. And there was a whole series of these articles. It's absolutely shocking. And nothing has changed much in 8 years. And we knew about it even before then. That's how strong these lobby groups are doing. You know, it's well known that what they're lobbying for is harmful. There are groups trying to stop it, but they have so many links to politicians and things like that, nothing really changes. Maybe they'll ban one particular chemical, but they just replace it with some new one. And it is almost unbelievable the lengths that these businesses went to. They even set up a Citizens for Fire Safety Institute, and it claimed to be a coalition of fire professionals and educators, community activists, etc., etc. And it wasn't. It was just a trade association set up by chemical companies. And then they made up fake stories of babies being burned to death and presented them before lawmakers. They had ads advertising killer couches and things like that, all based on lies. All based on lies that are killing babies, harming babies. I mean, this is like the most evil thing that, or obviously evil thing that you can do. How can it decide we can't agree that harming babies is to make money is a bad thing? And the more you get into this, the more and more corrupt this looks. And this is just one industry. But the things that they did to get that through and to push for these kind of regulations, that's exactly what these billionaires are doing now to try and promote climate change, to try and promote these family-destroying policies. It's the same thing. It's setting up fake Citizens for Fire Safety initiatives, these fake research institutes that are actually backed by politicians trying to change society. It worked. You know, look at the chair you're sitting on. It's got fire safety. It's got dangerous chemicals in it because of them. These tactics. And now they're using exactly the same tactics to try and radically transform society. And I have really got to speed up getting through this if I'm going to finish going through this subject. But you've also seen these companies, they're getting in bed in many ways with the political radical left. You're getting a lot of big businesses backing Joe Biden. You know, in general, this isn't a Democrat problem. This isn't a partisan issue. These businesses will work with both sides to advance their agenda. They worked with Republicans in many cases to get some of their fire safety things passed. They'll tend to support Democrats with the big business ties. They will support Republicans for the low taxation policies. And then Republicans tend to come with a more pro-business ethos, which can make them easier to work with sometimes. So this is not a partisan issue. But in the last few elections, or the last election especially, this did become more partisan. You remember that Time article that we've drawn attention to quite a lot where they boasted about how they stole the election. Here's what they wrote, and you've heard this quote before, but think about it from the angle of this subject. There was a conspiracy unfolding behind the scenes, one that both curtailed the protests and coordinated the resistance from CEOs. Both surprises were the result of an informal alliance between left-wing activists and business titans. There was a pact. The pact was formalized in a terse, little-notice joint statement from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO published on Election Day. businesses were working for Joe Biden. Big business, after the election, they wanted to bring about a Biden administration. They were cooperating in the steal. Big business helped in the steal. And this article talked about that and about how you had the business roundtable, a Washington-based group, CEO group. They were calling, opposing any kind of recounts or disputes of the election. And the Time article talked about how basically they did this for a quiet life. You know, they were afraid of the protests, so they didn't want this disruption to their business. The Time article at least makes it sound like it wasn't ideologically based. They just wanted a quiet life, and I'm sure that's true for many of these policies. But you're getting them backing the left. Back in October, CNBC, they wrote that Democrats had crushed Republicans in fundraising, quote, fueled at least in part by Wall Street executives. And then, like so many other things, this really kicked into overdrive after the January 6th riots. You had Stripe no longer processing payments to the Trump campaign. American Express, JP Morgan Chase, said they would no longer donate money to candidates that refused to certify the election. If you have any questions about the election, big business doesn't want to give you money. Goldman Sachs, they didn't publicly state this, but a source at the firm said that they were doing the same thing. No more donations to anybody who wants to contest the election. You either go along with the steal or big business is not behind you. Deutsche Bank distancing themselves from President Trump, saying that he's going to have to move his accounts from them. Bank United, their institution in Florida, saying they're cutting all ties with Donald Trump. And then when you start to get lots of radically left big businesses, radically left billionaires that want to change the world, and a radically left administration, you start to get some really interesting connections and a lot of power. Well, I did want to introduce you to BlackRock, this massive financial firm that it's so powerful it's been called a fourth branch of government because it does so much business with the US government, and it's basically got this revolving door relationship with the Obama administration, where people have come out of the Obama administration into top jobs and into BlackRock, and it now has more control or more influence in this new Obama administration than just about any financial firm has ever had. But if I want to get into what the Bible says about this, I'm going to have to set that aside, because that really is the most significant part of this story. You know, the Bible has a lot to say about the modern world, about politics, about moral conditions, about society. You know, does it have a lot to say about the rich and the impact they're having on society? You know, absolutely. You know, God has a lot to say from back to front in this Bible about business ethics, about people using dishonest business practices to steal. We talked about that before on this show. You know, he talks about how he hates people tilting the playing field, trying to cheat people. And then also, you know, businesses today have a huge amount of power, and actively or passively, they're going along with the radical left agenda. Either they support it or they're going along just for the sake of a quiet life. They are going along with it. And as we've talked about so much on this show, there's a spiritual reality behind this agenda that is pushing this. And big government is a part of that. Both Democrats and Republicans, big media, big tech, and so are big banks and big business. And we need to keep in mind what God thinks about this agenda. In Isaiah chapter 57 and verse 5, he accuses the modern society of slaying the children in the valleys, under the cliffs, and under the rocks. And in Isaiah's End Time Vision, Mr. Gerald Flurry talked about how, well, today we sacrifice our youth spiritually when we give them no uplifting vision. And he talked about how we sacrifice them to pornography and all these and drugs and music and all these other things, destroying their future. Well, what does God think about? You know, he was writing that before the LGBT movement became a big deal. What's that doing when you have companies producing toys that teach tiny toddlers that two fathers is normal, two mothers is normal? That's sacrificing their future. You know, we have our book, Redefining Family, that will show you more about how dangerous that agenda is. That's how God sees it. Sacrificing children. So, yes, God has a lot to say when business gets on board with that agenda, when the rich use their power and influence to get on board with that agenda, or just support that agenda so that they can keep making money. And the book of Amos has a lot to say about modern politics, and it has a lot to say about big business. You know, Amos 2 and verse 6, for example, talks about, you know, you've sold the poor into slavery to buy a pair of shoes. You know, or we've got regulations today that do real harm just so a few people can get a bit more money to buy a pair of shoes. There's so many scriptures here. You know, Amos 5 and verse 11, you see him condemning the rich. And then verse 12, it tells you why. It's not just he's condemning them because they're rich, but because they bribe people. They deceive. They afflict people. They turn aside the poor. They set up fake grassroots organizations to push their own agenda. In Amos 3 and verse 10, God describes all of these big houses, and he says it's based on robbery. You're not making an honest living. And Amos 6 is really worth reading. It applies, I mean, it's something that we can also take personal correction from. I know I can. It's something, he talks about woe to them that are at ease in Zion and trust in the Mount of Samaria. Those that, in verse 4, lie upon beds of ivory, that stretch themselves out on couches. On verse 5, that chant the sound of the viol and invent to themselves instruments of music like David. They drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the chief ointments, but they are not grieved for the afflictions of Joseph. You know, our people are being afflicted today, but so many are comfortable. Rich and even just middle class say, we can live pretty comfortable lives and not be grieved by what's going on around us. And God condemns that. But then this book has so much, you know, it talks about how God is going to completely destroy that society. That's the only way to deal with it. But then it's also filled with hope. God concludes with this picture of a new society. Completely different. Where there is general prosperity. God isn't against wealth and against riches. And you can read this in the end of Amos chapter 9. He gets rid of the sin that makes us miserable. And he brings in a new society that brings in peace, prosperity, and right education and living for everyone. Well, thanks for listening. This has been the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can send us any comments at td@kpcg.fm. Please do tune in tomorrow at our website, thetrumpet.com, or 101.3 on the FM dial. And I believe you'll be having your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, back in the hot seat.